Welcome to Central Coast Voices, a program addressing the ramifications of change in our communities and beyond, and how today's choices will impact tomorrow's community. This program is a combined project of KCBX and our team of program hosts. Today, our program focuses on the Alien Enemies Act, which authorized the mass incarceration of Japanese Americans during World War II. Kathy Masoka and Dr. Russell Endo talk to our host, Lada Murdy, about why they are protesting the renewed use of the act against immigrants living in the U.S., including California's Central Coast, today. We invite you to learn and listen to our conversation. This program is pre-recorded, and so you can send follow-up questions that you may have to voices@kcbx.org. And with that, let's join Lada and her guests. Over to you, Lada.
Well, thank you, Brad. So during the first half of this show, I will be talking to Dr. Russell Endo, a retired professor of sociology and Asian American studies at the University of Colorado. And during the second half of the show, I will be talking to Kathy Masaoka of Nikkei Progressives, based in Little Tokyo, Los Angeles. And both Kathy and Russ have ties to the Central Coast. Russ, tell us about your ties to California's Central Coast.
Okay, I grew up in Southern California, and my ties are mostly in the nature of visiting the Central Coast, primarily for three reasons. One is that my mother had a passionate interest in the history of the California missions. And so, of course, one of the most iconic missions was at Santa Barbara. So we made numerous trips up there in and around the Santa Barbara area when I was small. And then when I got a little older, my father used to take me on his surf fishing trips. And we'd go to Carpinteria and Goleta. And we'd fish in the ocean also off the coast near Guadalupe. And I remember when we went up there, we used to stop at the Masatani Market in the morning, early in the morning, to pick up things to eat for lunch. And then we'd stop there again and chit-chat with everybody on the way out and give them some fish. So those were my childhood experiences. When I was actually in high school, I considered going to Cal Poly at San Luis Obispo. And so I made a couple of trips up to San Luis Obispo. And I actually was there for about a week in a special program for prospective college students. I didn't end up going to Cal Poly, but I still remember the area very well. And more recently, professionally, I have a lot of friends in Santa Barbara. So those are my main contacts with the Central Coast.
Great. And Masatani's Market, of course, was in Guadalupe.
Yes.
Yes. Wonderful. So tell us more about how the Central Coast is part of your current research.
Okay, well, what I've been doing is I'm looking at the arrest and confinement of so-called enemy aliens. These are Japanese, German, and Italian leaders who were picked up during the war under the Alien Enemies Act. And this is part of my work for one of the confinement sites that people were held at. It's in Tahunga in Southern California. It's called the Tuna Canyon Detention Station. So let me just run through some background history. Before World War II, the U.S. government was anticipating that it was going to be going to war. So as one precautionary effort, various government agencies began making lists of Japanese, German, and Italian community leaders who they thought they might need to arrest at the beginning of the war because they were risks to U.S. security. So when the war breaks out, the FBI arrests a lot of people, including several hundred initially in Southern California and several thousand throughout the U.S. And this actually includes 16 very prominent business leaders from Santa Barbara and San Luis Obispo counties. So they were swept up in the initial arrest. And then there was a slight pause, I think, because the FBI thought that maybe they had arrested everybody who might be a suspect. Actually, none of these people were really threats to security, but the FBI thought they were. So Hoover concluded that maybe he had arrested everybody. But in January, there was a lot of public pressure, especially in California, and especially against the Japanese. People were up in arms about the Japanese who were living in California and also Washington and Oregon.
And this is January of what year?
January of 1942.
1942.
And they wanted people to do something. Some of this was prompted by just anti-war hysteria because the Japanese enemy had attacked Pearl Harbor. Some of this, unfortunately, was promoted by agricultural interests, including those in Santa Barbara and San Luis Obispo counties, because there were certain people who wanted to take over the land that the Japanese were farming, and they thought they could do this more easily if the Japanese were removed. And then there were also politicians who were trying to, enhance their political careers by saying things against the Japanese. And one of these was the Santa Barbara District Attorney, Percy Heckendorf, who lobbied very hard for the removal of Japanese. So there's a pause in the arrests of people, but then the FBI gets the message that they should be doing more. So they begin in February 1942 to do mass arrests of people in certain areas of Southern California. And Santa Barbara County was hit in the middle of February 1942. In total, about 265 Japanese and a couple of Germans were arrested in Santa Barbara and the southern part of San Luis Obispo County. And coupled with earlier arrests and subsequent arrests, there were about 310 people who were arrested. Most of them were men, but there was one woman. And these were all completely innocent people. The Japanese were mainly heads of community organizations like the Japanese Association. They were prominent agricultural leaders or other business leaders. Some of them were religious leaders. They were the head of the Buddhist church or Christian churches. And then Japanese language school teachers were especially targeted as well. So there's a mass arrest in Southern California, and Santa Barbara County and San Luis Obispo County's turn came in the middle of February. In total, the about 2,500 people were arrested in Southern California. And these arrests actually are occurring elsewhere, all across the country, even in New York and Boston and Chicago, Kansas City, Colorado. There are people arrested and all up and down the West Coast. And in total, during the war, about 31,000 enemy aliens were arrested. And this had devastating consequences for the families, because families were separated. Usually it was the father who was separated from the rest of the family. But in some cases, both the father and the wife and his wife were arrested. So they left behind children who had to fend for themselves. And as you might imagine, all of these arrests also had a very chilling effect on community organizations. So the churches cut back on their activities. The language school stopped holding classes. And a lot of economic activity suffered. The Japanese community had stores and restaurants and boarding houses and hotels and doctors and dentist offices. And they lost a lot of business. People didn't know what to do, so they stopped going out and buying things and were mainly prepared for the worst. And I think the major effect that this has, and you see this very clearly in Santa Barbara and San Luis Obispo counties, is that the arrest took away all of the senior leaders in the community. So the community is actually vulnerable to further government actions. And in fact, later in 1942, as you know, President Roosevelt signs Executive Order 9066, which enables the mass incarceration of all Japanese citizens and non-citizens from the West Coast. And in Santa Barbara County, it was easier for the Army to facilitate the removal of people from their homes without protest because all the senior leaders were gone. So this really had devastating consequences for individuals and also for the communities itself.
And was your own family affected?
My family was arrested. My grandfather was arrested. He was not. He was living in San Pedro, so he's not in Santa Barbara County. But what happened with my grandfather was that my family was actually getting ready for the mass evacuation under Executive Order 9066. They had just gotten a notice saying that they had to leave their homes in about a week to report to a detention station. And then the next day, an FBI agent showed up and arrested my grandfather. And he was taken to the Tuna Canyon detention station. And partly because of this, my family had to get rid of all of their possessions or take care of everything, the business and their house and everything, in just a few short days without his guidance. And they ended up selling, he was a fisherman, so they ended up selling his fishing boat and his barges for about 7% of their value because they didn't have time to, you know, solicit more bids. And I guess people were sort of waiting for him, waiting for the price to go way down because they knew my family had to sell. And my family actually suffered, in terms of today's dollars, about $850,000 in loss.
Wow.
And a lot of this had to do with the fact that my grandfather wasn't there to help things out. Now, they still would have suffered a lot of loss anyway, but it might not have been as severe. So my grandfather was taken to the Tuna Canyon Detention Station, which was in Southern California. And he had no idea why he was arrested. And for a long time, the family didn't quite know where he was, and then they finally figured it out. And my father actually made a visit out there. My grandfather had a hearing, which is something that was granted to all enemy aliens. And his hearing was done in the Los Angeles federal building. And the hearings were not trials. There wasn't any due process. The hearings were held before a civilian panel of three people. There was no judge involved. And the detainees, like my grandfather, were not allowed to have attorneys. And they didn't know what charges were being brought against them. And they were basically there answering allegations that the hearing board presumed to be true unless they could be refuted. So my grandfather was charged with, since he was a fisherman, he was charged with making contact with the Japanese enemy through the use of his boat, passing information on to the Japanese enemy. He was accused of monitoring U.S. naval traffic from his fishing boat. And he was affiliated with a language school, Japanese language school, which was the reason why he was arrested. So he was accused of, like other language school teachers, of fostering imperial Japanese propaganda, teaching that to his students in the language school. And my grandfather refuted all of these things. He thought the charges were ridiculous. He was actually involved with the language school because he wanted the second generation, my father's generation, to learn Japanese so they could communicate better with their parents, who were immigrants from Japan. So my father would have been interned for the rest of the war, except that the FBI, in its haste to try to, I guess, make him appear guilty, argued that they had picked up some contraband from his house at the time of his arrest. The Japanese were not allowed to have things like shortwave radios and cameras and binoculars and things like that. And so the FBI made this allegation at the hearing that they had to take these things away from him when he was arrested. And my grandfather said, well, wait a minute here. I had actually turned these things earlier to the police as I was asked to do. And he had receipts to prove this. So the FBI was basically caught lying. And I think because of this embarrassment to the government's case, I think they paroled him rather than continued his imprisonment. So he was paroled to rejoin his family, which was at the Santa Anita detention station. And then the whole family got sent off to a war relocation authority. authority camps in Arkansas, in Jerome and Roar.
Thank you for sharing that. I'd like to ask you more about that in relation to the Alien Enemies Act, but first let me let our listeners know that they are listening to Central Coast Voices on KCBX, your Central Coast listener-supported radio station. I'm Lotta Murty, and my guest during the first half of today's pre-recorded show is Dr. Russell Endo, a retired professor of sociology and Asian American studies at the University of Colorado. During the second half of the show, I will be talking to Kathy Masaoka of Nikkei Progressives, based in Little Tokyo, Los Angeles. And we are talking about the Alien Enemies Act, how and why it came about, and why we should all care about this act today. You can email us at voices@kcbx.org with questions that we can share later with Russ and Kathy after today's show. So, Russ, all of these false charges against your father, did they fall under the Alien Enemies Act?
Yes, yes.
And tell us more about this act.
Okay, well, this has been in the news a lot, but the Alien Enemies Act was part of the Alien and Sedition Acts passed in 1798. At that time, the U.S. was concerned about a war with France, so the government passed all these internal security measures. And the only one that remains from this is the Alien Enemies Act, and I'll talk about that in just a second. It's actually only been used three times. All three times were during wars. It was used in the War of 1812. It was used in World War I, and then it was used in World War II. And what the Alien Enemies Act allows the president to do is to issue a proclamation. And having issued the proclamation, he has complete authority to do whatever he wants to the citizens of enemy nations who are not citizens of the U.S. So, for example, my grandfather was a citizen of Japan, which was the enemy, and that was mainly because he could not become a citizen of the U.S. So the government was able to do whatever they wanted with my grandfather. And initially what happened was the Alien Enemies Act allowed the government to do some preliminary things, like it established a curfew for enemy aliens, and it established travel restrictions. And then, as I mentioned before, enemy aliens had to turn in contraband. But later on, the FBI just went in and arrested people who they thought were suspicious. And the Alien Enemies Act has been reinstated, I guess is the way to use it, more recently. President Trump has used it to deport a couple of hundred Venezuelans to a prison in El Salvador. And very quickly, the ACLU stepped in and filed a lawsuit which blocked the deportation. And there have been a couple of Supreme Court rulings. Right now, the case is going up to an appeals court, federal circuit court appeal, and but the government so far is able to deport people, but they have to give people notice, and they have to give them some opportunity to have a hearing, to file petitions of habeas corpus. So what the government did this last weekend, and some of your listeners will know about this, is that the government tried to sneak some more Venezuelans out quietly from their holding areas in Texas. And the ACLU got the Supreme Court to intervene in the middle of the night to issue an order stopping that. So everything on this is pending. The big problem with the Alien Enemies Act is that there's no due process. Act does not provide any provision for due process. It gives the president complete power over whatever he or she wants to do with people who are designated as enemy aliens. There's also no oversight or no guardrails. So technically, the president can do this all in secrecy, and he's not required, he or she is not required to make any reports. Now, Trump has actually tried to do this, and the ACLU has been sort of following him around and reporting on what's been going on. But that's not a requirement under the Ada Enemies Act. There are no exceptions for permanent residents or refugees, so people with green cards can be deported. And one of the difficulties with the Alien Enemies Act is that it's difficult to correct mistakes. And as your listeners will probably know, there's a gentleman who is in a prison in El Salvador named Armando Abrego Garcia, who was swept up in President Trump's recent deportation effort by mistake. He was not supposed to be arrested, but he was swept away. And it's difficult under the Alien Enemies Act to rectify mistakes. During World War II, some American citizens were actually arrested by mistake, and they were held for weeks, sometimes a couple of months. And it was not easy in all cases to get the citizens out. There were also people who were citizens of non-enemy nations, a small handful, such as Canada, who were arrested, and it was difficult to get them out of the internment system. So that's one of the issues, I think, with the Enemy Aliens Act. It's very difficult to rectify mistakes, mainly because there's no oversight. There are no guidelines on what the government should be doing or not doing.
I'm surprised this act is still in effect as part of our country's policy.
Yeah.
Without any changes.
Yeah, most people, I guess, didn't anticipate this was going to happen, although I guess some people worried about it. And there was an effort that was introduced in Congress, which is still pending, to repeal the Alien Enemies Act, because some congressional representatives realized that a president could use this in abuse the Alien Enemies Act in ways that other people were not going to like. And so there is legislation pending to repeal it. But until now, I think most people thought that this was never going to be invoked unless there was a war. And since there has not been a declaration of war recently, I guess some people were lulled into thinking the president would never use this. And what the current president has done is he's twisted the meaning of the act, and so he's using it in times of peace. We have not declared war against Venezuela or anybody else, but he's redefined, I guess, some provisions in the act to argue that the country's being invaded by immigrants, notably in this case by gangs from Venezuela. But potentially he could use this to argue that there have been other invasions or other unfriendly incursions, and to apply the act. So,
I think
this caught me by surprise, and certainly a lot of other people, because we're certainly not at war with anybody right at the moment.
Indeed, I didn't know about the act until this current moment. I mean, I'd heard of it referred to, but I thought it was in our past. Obviously, it's not. And the Japanese American community has recognized that and has been mobilizing against the reinstating of the Alien Enemies Act, correct?
Yes. Yes. Actually, even before Trump invoked the act, the community mobilized against the repeal of the Enemy Aliens Act. There's legislation that's proposed, which is called the Neighbors, Not Enemies Act, which would repeal the Alien Enemies Act. And so the Japanese community was in support of this new legislation and continues actually to support it. There have been protests by the Japanese community, notably in San Francisco and Los Angeles. And these have received a lot of attention. People have been doing interviews, and there are people like myself who are contributing to amicus briefs, which will be filed with the Supreme Court in conjunction with other legal groups who are going to be arguing against the constitutionality of the Alien Enemies Act. And I'm not supposed to talk too much about this, but there are members of the community, including your next guest, who are involved with these briefs, mainly by sharing historical information about what happened during the war, the World War II, and what happened to our families. So people are actively fighting back within the community. I think this has encouraged other Japanese Americans to speak up. And I think this is having an effect gradually. In February, for example, the Colorado Senate, State Senate, out here in Denver, introduced a resolution condemning the use of the Alien Enemies Act and encouraging its repeal. And efforts by Japanese Americans are producing similar kinds of results. So I think people are speaking up. And I think it's with the realization that this happened to our community before. A lot of our leaders were taken away. And, you know, we just don't want this to happen again to any other group.
How can our listeners support these efforts?
I think this is advice, I guess, that's been given out generally for a lot of things. But I think people should write to their senators or congressmen or congresswomen, their representatives, to pass the Neighbors But Not Enemies Act. This is the act that would repeal the Alien Enemies Act. I think people should also write to their representatives to support due process in deportation efforts. The Trump administration is using the Alien Enemies Act specifically because they think they can get away with this without any due process protections. There are other immigration deportation proceedings that the government can use, but some of them have restrictions, such as hearings or other kinds of protections. And I think people should write to their representatives encouraging the government to provide due process in their deportation proceedings. And then some of your listeners will also know that in preparation, maybe for the deportation of large numbers of Cubans, Haitians, Nicaraguans, and people from Afghanistan, as well as more people from Venezuela, the administration has removed their temporary protective status, the conditions which allowed them to come to the U.S. And to obtain work here. I think people should write in support of the restoration of these temporary protection status.
Thank you very much, Dr. Russell Endo, for calling in and speaking to us from Colorado about the Alien Enemies Act and what it meant for Japanese Americans during World War II and what it means for immigrants in the U.S. today. We greatly appreciate it. Now we are going to take a short break to hear from our studio.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Central Coast Voices. Today's show is on the Alien Enemies Act and why members of the Japanese American community, including those on California's Central Coast, have been mobilizing against use of the Alien Enemies Act today. Before the break, I spoke to Dr. Russell Endo, a retired professor of sociology and Asian American studies at the University of Colorado. And now I have Kathy Masaoka on the phone for the second half of the show. Kathy is a member of Nikkei Progressives based in Little Tokyo, Los Angeles. Listeners, this is a pre-recorded show, but you can email your questions to voices@kcbx.org. And we will share them with our guests. Kathy, thank you for talking to me today. Tell us about Nikkei Progressives.
Okay, Nikkei Progressives is an intergenerational organization that formed around the first election of the first term for Trump. And we come out of the movement for Japanese American reparations. So many of us are third generation. We also have fourth and fifth generation in our organization. But those of us that are a little bit older come out of the movement for reparations and have carried that into Nikkei Progressives. One of our first actions was around supporting immigrants and the threat of their being kept out of the country and the Muslim ban and things like that.
And what does Nikkei mean?
Nikkei is the term that is used for the diaspora of Japanese that have traveled. I've left Japan and all over the world, really, South America, Europe, the U.S. So people that are descendants from Japan, Japanese folks that live elsewhere are called Nikkei. So there used to be a Nikkei in Brazil, a Nikkei here in the U.S. as well, or any place in the world, really.
And what generation of Japanese Americans do you identify with?
Well, I am third generation, born after World War II. And so I identify with that grouping of people that came of age, especially in the late 60s, and greatly influenced by the movement for ethnic studies and third world solidarity.
And how did you get involved in Nikkei Progressives?
It's sort of a continuation of getting involved in ethnic studies at UC Berkeley in the late 60s and coming into realizing that my family had been incarcerated. You know, I knew a little bit about it. I didn't understand it. And it's been a path of growing and understanding what that experience was about since that time. I got involved with the Little Tokyo community, got involved with Japanese American Redress in the 80s and 90s. Continue to build solidarity with other organizations, such as the Muslim community, and today with Nikkei Progressives, continuing to support immigrants and Black reparations.
And how did Nikkei Progressives get involved in protesting the Alien Enemies Act?
Well, you know, we are Japanese Americans, and you know, we think a lot about the incarceration experience. We also have been working with the Inland Coalition for Immigrant Justice in San Bernardino and the effort to shut down the detention centers there, which are now being filled up again. So we've been working with people in the coalition, you know, around immigration support, against family separation, releasing the children, and, you know, and also supporting those that are released from prison and then being deported right after they are released. So we've been in this effort for quite a number of years, ever since we formed. So it's been part of our involvement, and it does come out of an understanding of our own experience as Japanese Americans having been incarcerated.
And indeed, you and Nikkei Progressives organized a recent protest against the Alien Enemies Act, correct?
Yes. We felt it was really important to speak up against it because it's reminiscent of, you know, what happened to our first generation Issei, who were immigrant. They weren't allowed to become citizens, so they had green cards. but, you know, they were rounded up. And also, I think what made us really fearful is that, you know, the inhumane way that people are being treated today, the immigrant population, and they're not being looked at as human beings. And I think it made us also reflect on our own community, how our first generation were being treated and the way that it impacted our community. And it is a slippery slope, frankly, to then incarcerating citizens, which scarily is being voiced again, you know, talking about this could be used, this kind of law or action could be used against people or citizens. And it was used against Japanese Americans, not the law per se, but it kind of led to that, you know, sort of like a justification, an acceptance, and then putting people, citizens, into, you know, to camps. And then realizing later, when it was challenged by the Supreme in the Supreme Court by Mr. Endo, that it was unconstitutional. So, you know, things are carried out, they're acted out, and then later on they're found to be unconstitutional. But it still happens.
And your family knows this from firsthand experience, correct?
You know, they didn't really know it. I mean, they knew, of course, that their father, my grandfather, Issei Soshi Kudoda, was picked up by the FBI. A lot of the details, for whatever reason, didn't get passed down clearly to my generation. So I had a lot of misinformation until speaking and finding out from Dr. Russell Endo some of the details. But which really kind of stunned me, because I always thought he was a lone, one Issei person, first generation, picked up by the FBI, and that was it. That's what the family said. He was picked up by the FBI. Okay, fine. Many people were. I didn't realize the immensity of the situation in Santa Barbara and in Santa Maria, where over 265 first-generation men were picked up in 3 days. And when I understood that, and my family didn't know that, they just knew he was taken and that he ended up in Bismarck, North Dakota. And then they saw him later at Tulare Fairgrounds. They didn't know what happened in between. They didn't know that he was taken to the Santa Barbara jail. They didn't know that he was here in Los Angeles in the overflow in Griffith Park. And I live like 1 mile away. I could walk to Griffith Park. I didn't know that until maybe 2 or 3 years ago that my grandfather had been there. So a lot of history, a lot of stories we don't know, and we're still uncovering that information. And I think when I realized the impact on the community, it was rather stunning, the fact that almost every father was probably picked up by the FBI in Santa Barbara County and in Santa Maria area. They lived in Oro Grande area. But so it left the families without father. It left them, the mothers. My grandmother had 10 children, and my mother was the oldest citizen child. So it left them really at a loss and in a panic. And I just can't even imagine what it did to the Japan towns. But the families were left to tend for themselves.
Yeah, I can't imagine either, but in fact, this is happening again currently, yes?
Exactly. I mean, the parallels are almost, you know, as I think about more what happened, the rounding up, you know, the Venezuelan, 265 rounded up, Issei, Japanese men in Santa Barbara County. And then I read that also they were stopped, and they're being stopped now. People just stopped in their cars and being pulled out and being detained. That happened in Santa Barbara as well. And then being taken far away, and their families don't even know where they are. What is the justification of that? Taking them not only to the jail, okay, that's maybe nearby, but taking them to places like Bismarck, Missoula, Montana, Lordsburg and Santa Fe, New Mexico, so far away that the families really have no contact with them. That's, you know, it's been happening today, taking people very far away so the families can, there's no support for them, or very hard to support for them. and very hard to and if, of course, in World War II, they had no way of contacting their fathers.
So what can our listeners do now, particularly on the Central Coast or in California?
Well, I think it's important to know the history, that this has happened before, and it's even, and it's the 1798 law, so it happened way back, right? And so it's a continuity of that history, and it's got to be broken. I kind of wish that we understood what that law was a little sooner to actually challenge it. But that law has to be challenged. And I think what we're doing now as a Japanese American community, people are challenging that law and saying it should be neighbors, not enemies, you know, is the act that is being proposed, and people can support that. But I think that we also have to stand firm as citizens. And I really don't like the distinction between immigrants and citizens, but at this point in time, we have to support immigrants, but we also have to draw the line, because, you know, what is being talked about, a citizen, of denying the rights and due process of citizens. Due process is due everybody, and I think we have to stand up for that. Everybody is owed due process. Our community didn't have that during World War II, but everybody, including immigrants, have the right to due process. And I think that we as citizens have to step up, speak up, support everybody in that right. And, you know, and when it comes to ourselves, we have to speak up as citizens and not be afraid to do that.
This is Lotta Murty with you for Central Coast Voices on KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, your listener-supported radio station. If you recently joined us for today's show and want to listen to the entire broadcast, you can. It's available on our website at www.kcbx.org under the On Demand tab. Click on Central Coast Voices and you will find this show and many others to choose from. And please do not hesitate to send your questions about the Alien Enemies Act, Nikkei Progressives, and how both are impacting the United States today. Please send your questions to voices@kcbx.org, and we will pass them on to our guests. My guest during the second half of the show is Kathy Masaoka, a member of Nikkei Progressives, based in Little Tokyo, Los Angeles. In the first half of the show, I spoke to Dr. Russell Endo, a retired professor of sociology and Asian American studies at the University of Colorado. And we are talking about the Alien Enemies Act, what it has meant for Japanese Americans, or Nikkei, and what it means for all of us in the U.S. today. So, Kathy, are you able to tell us more about the recent protest, what that was like? Can you describe it to us?
Yes. We pulled it together very, very quickly in about a span of 3 days, because we knew that it was something that needed to be addressed and people needed to speak up about it. Our community responded very quickly. We had speakers from the Japanese American National Museum, from the Japanese American Citizens League, from our group, Nikkei Progressives, from the Manzanar Committee. We had someone also from the Trinitan Detention, people from Santa Barbara County were brought to. We also had an older woman, June Burke, who had been incarcerated. She was in her 90s, but she came out to share what she went through and what her experiences were at being incarcerated as a younger person. So a lot of media came out. People spoke about, you know, the fact that the slippery slope in terms of what's going on with the Alien Enemies Act, and that it's something that needed to be opposed. You know, they spoke about the conditions that people faced at Tuna Canyon and the impact on the community. Manzanar Committee spoke very strongly about opposing the Alien Enemies Act and you know, the dangers that we face in this country now. So that was kind of the press conference. It was on the steps of the Japanese American National Museum Plaza, facing the old church where people actually had gathered. So it was a very opportune and appropriate place to have the press conference, because right across from where we were was the area that Japanese Americans in Los Angeles gathered with their suitcases to load the bus that took them to Manzanar. So that was the press conference. It wasn't too long. There's a lot of media that came out. And we also, I almost forgot this, we had a speaker from the Inland Coalition for Immigrant Justice speaking about what they're going through as the immigrant community, the fears that they have, and I think also about the support and solidarity that has been built between the Japanese American community and their community. So they were there to lend their voices and to explain what was happening to their community. We ended with that, and there was a media from from Japan, so Japanese media and Spanish media, as well as the regular media.
Wow, it sounds like it was an emotional event. Have you noticed any effects, any impact that this protest has had?
I think so. I mean, it's not only in L.A., but up and down, you know, California and San Jose, San Francisco, and other organizations and people mobilizing, it got a lot of media coverage, and people were very glad to see that. So we got a lot of responses from people. It was on 3 or 4 different major media in L.A. So we did hear about getting out, and I think it's important for our community to speak up. So I think it did have an impact, and there are people that are now, of course, organizing, amicus briefs to oppose what's going on with the deportation and the use of the Alien Enemies Act. I hope a lot of education went out. I think that, it's important for, Japanese Americans, yes, because we experienced it, but for all Americans to speak up.
And what did you feel personally in organizing and being there at the protest? What's the personal impact it had for you?
You know, it's sort of like this history that I didn't know, and even my family didn't know. That when I actually was interviewed by the media too to talk about that experience, and it is emotional when I think about it, because I think about how my mother and the family felt, and I could feel the panic that most of the community felt, and I also feel very angry because so many of our Japan towns were destroyed by the incarceration. And, it wasn't justified to pick up the first generation. They had committed no crime. They hadn't been allowed to become citizens, so they had green cards. There was nothing that they had done against this country. This was their life. They were going to build their life here. My grandfather came here as a young man and worked here for 10 years and then went back to get married and had a child. And still came back. He returned to this country with a family and built, a life here, not able to own land in the area, and had 9 more children. And his intention was to stay here. And so you think about that their hopes and dreams were here. And the children were citizens. They were beginning to build their life, and their dreams were, ahead of them. My mother was 22, when she went to camp. So you think about all of that and how they maintained, they persevered. It's almost, as I think about conditions being very tough for us now, I can't even imagine what it took to withstand the disappointment, the disillusionment, the shock, the betrayal that they must have felt. And also the racism that they experienced from people around them. And yet they did. Some didn't survive that. There are a lot of emotional, mental issues that happened. And I did think, our community suffered. My grandfather could never start over again. He was in his 60s by the time the war ended. And he got out of camp. So the family started over again. And, you know, they put that behind them. They stuffed it inside. And, you know, I understand why they didn't talk about it. They didn't really know probably how to explain it to us, their children. And so, you know, we experience their pain now.
Yeah, yeah. There's certainly intergenerational trauma. Thank you for sharing that. And it is emotional. Can you tell us what's next in terms of Nikkei Progressive's plans?
Well, we're really, around the Alien Enemies Act, we're supporting, of course, the amicus brief and the opposition to the use of the Alien Enemies Act against immigrants. And we'll continue to support that. And concretely, we're also part of a Little Tokyo Rapid Response Network here and trying to educate people on knowing their rights. Everybody needs to know their rights. Everybody, not just immigrants, not just people who are undocumented or people who have green cards. All of us do. So we're doing that work around knowing your rights, but we're also specifically making sure that people in Little Tokyo are protected, the businesses, the workers, all of us that live here and work here, and supporting the LA Rapid Response Network with an organization called CHIRLA. So we are part of those kind of networks. We're supporting people that are facing deportation that are from Southeast Asia that came here as children, made mistakes in their youth, served their time in prison, and then are picked up by ICE immediately and transferred to detention. And one has already been deported. We communicate with him in Cambodia, try to support him. We want to prevent any more deportations of people like that. So we work with an organization called API RISE, an Asian Pacific organization that is a reentry organization. And they're here in Little Tokyo. We are supporting people that are going to their ICE hearings and hoping that, you know, and asking for pardons from Governor Newsom for many for them so that they don't get deported. So it's just a lot of daily concrete kind of work here and educating ourselves and others.
Yes, thank you for doing that work. In our last few minutes, what would you like our listeners, particularly here on California's Central Coast, to take away from your experience, your family's experience, from what Nikkei Progressives is doing and what's going on today?
Well, I think for myself, I think I've learned to really review history and to think about it and to learn from it and to know that it's not just, you know, different communities. It's really a long-term kind of a pattern of treatment of people and a thinking that immigrants are disposable. And yet this country, I think we have to remember that this country was built by immigrants and that, you know, it's people are come here with dreams and for a better life. And all of us have come here for that, except for the indigenous people and the African-American folks who were brought here. But we have to remember that, and that people need to be treated as human beings, and that we can't make a distinction between immigrants and ourselves as citizens, because that line is so thin, it could be taken away at any moment, as we've been seeing. The rule of law, we have to maintain the rule of law and respect for the Constitution. But I think most of all, we have to remember people's basic humanity.
Thank you, Kathy. I want to thank both of our guests today, Kathy Masaoka of Nikkei Progressives, based in Little Tokyo, Los Angeles, and Dr. Russell Endo, a retired professor of sociology and Asian American studies at the University of Colorado. We have been talking about the Alien Enemies Act, how it was used against Japanese Americans, and what the act means for all Americans today. Next week, join Dr. Mario Espinosa-Kulik as he talks to guests about more issues, events, and organizations making a difference on California's Central Coast. You are invited to listen, learn, and participate in the conversation on Thursday, May 1st, between 1 and 2 p.m. I'm Lotta Murty. Thank you for joining us today.
The Road Home is a weekly radio show of music rooted in American tradition. And that's a tradition built on musical influences from all over the world. I'm Marisa Waddell. Tune in every Thursday night for The Road Home, Americana music, its roots, and its branches, with plenty of new releases and lots of favorites, too. That's Thursday nights from 6:30 to 8, right after All Things Considered, for any time on demand at kcbx.org.
Americana, roots, whatever you want to label it, it's been influential and worldwide, and that world has influenced it too. From Scandinavian rockabilly to straight-up country tunes from Canada, the Nashville Cats, Woody Guthrie, and the Dead and the Almonds, I explore it all on Across the Tracks. Hi, I'm Brad, and I hope that you'll join me Thursday nights from 8 to 10 or anytime on demand on Public Radio, KCBX.